This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 16th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Today I'm joined by the writer Mark Mason for our weekly books analysis. Up for discussion, we have a triple bill of non-fiction reads, including two new releases, 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon, which delves into the physiology and psychology required to go the distance, and All Day Long, A Portrait of Britain at Work, an investigation into what we do during our working day. And as legend, Brian Helgeland's film about the Cray brothers hits cinemas this autumn, we take a look at the re-release of John Pearson's biography, The Profession of Violence, which details the lives of these notorious criminals. That's all to come here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Mark. We're going to kick things off with Ed Caesar's book on some of the greatest long-distance runners, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon. Here, Caesar traces the history of the race and looks at the physical and psychological demands it puts on runners. Mark, what did you make of this?
I loved it. It's something that's fascinated me ever since the London Olympic Marathon, 3 years ago now. The night before the marathon, we were going to watch it, a friend and I, and the night before we realised that we knew the record was just over 2 hours. It's now 2:02:57, I think, that's it. And so, you know, very quick maths tells you that that's 13 miles an hour. And we thought, that's incredible. I couldn't run at 13 miles an hour for 10 yards. And we worked out that that meant that, you know, the Olympic Marathon, elite marathon runners are doing every 100 metres in 17 seconds. And when you consider that Usain Bolt, you know, for one flat out 100 metres, he's doing 10 seconds, that, you know, pretty incredible. And so we mapped out a course on the street outside my friend's house and tried to do 100 metres each and could only just do it 100 metres in 17 seconds. And it's just an astonishing feat, you know, when you watch a marathon, they look pretty much in control. They're going flat out as fast as you or I could run, assuming you're an unfit 43-year-old like me, Matt, which you're probably not. They're going flat out, you know, for 26 miles. It really is an astonishing feat. And the book really, that's the fascination. As the book itself says, it's not really about running. It's about pushing yourself. It's about what you can find inside yourself. And that's really where the fascination of the subject comes from.
Absolutely. I mean, at the centre of this work, it does feel like there's kind of this very human need to sort of test ourselves to the limits. Do you think Caesar's making kind of a broader point here about human endeavour?
Absolutely. That's why it's what, you know, I did a marathon. I did the New York Marathon a few years ago, and lots of people do it who've got no real interest in sport or athletics or running. It's seen as a very accessible, easy thing to do just to test yourself because there's no real physical skill. It's just a case of training. But then, the book does go into the physical side of it as well, looking at the genetics, because most marathon runners come from one very specific part of Africa. And it's one tribe, the Kalenjin. I hope I've pronounced that right, Kalenjin tribe. They're originally a valley tribe, but they moved up into the mountains. So there's a little quirk there that they've got huge lung surface area of people who were born at altitude. But they've still got the sort of sea level ancestry, as he calls it, that lets their hemoglobin respond quickly to training. So, you know, there is a physical side to it. And geneticists have been looking into, is there a genetic side to being able to run marathons quickly? And, you know, there's a huge amount of interest of that in the book. But yeah, as you say, what makes it an accessible story and an accessible book is it's just that determination to push yourself and how much can you do and what happens when you hit the wall at 20 miles. And that's something that I think any of us can respond to.
Absolutely. You mentioned that tribe in Kenya. I mean, Caesar focuses a lot of the book on Geoffrey Mutai, who was this Kenyan runner who ran the fastest marathon ever in 2011. It's kind of interesting that Mutai seems to have the perfect coincidence, really, of genetics, upbringing and sort of natural willpower to achieve this 2-hour marathon. And that's kind of what's at the heart of this book.
Yeah. And he's got a great personal story as well. You know, born in poverty, there's a civil war, had a bit of a drink problem when he was growing up, and also a difficult relationship with his father as well. And so it's a great human story. Like, I was talking about the book to them, they said all really great sports books are about more than just the sport itself. you know, Seabiscuit, the story is not just a story about horse racing, it's a story about someone's triumph over adversity. So there's all that in there as well. And, but, you know, the really fascinating stuff is where it's going to go from here. How long is it going to be, or will we ever have a case of someone breaking 2 hours for the marathon? And the big sportswear trainer manufacturers have got teams working on it, you know, trying to work out the little technologies in their shoes that can do it. And also geneticists looking at, you know, trying to predict when it might happen. There's one prediction that it'll be some point in the late 2020s. But then they said that, you know, it said that no one was going to run as fast as Usain Bolt for another 20 years. And then Usain Bolt came along. So there's always that freak. There's always that freak case of, you know, the outlier who can come along and absolutely blow everyone's mind.
Fascinating stuff. The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon by Ed Caesar is out today here in the UK, published by Viking, and will be out on American bookshelves by Simon & Schuster in October. Let's move on now to All Day Long, A Portrait of Britain at Work by Joanna Biggs. The book is an exploration of 32 different working days, from that of a ballerina to a care worker's, and pretty much covers everything in between as well. What makes work such an interesting subject to tackle in a book like this, Mark?
Again, very similar to the first book we were talking about, it's about the people rather than about the actual notional subject of the book. You know, the author is interviewed, you know, the people doing these jobs, as you say, shoemakers, fishmongers, lawyers, baristas. And you get the impression, the thing I kept thinking all the way through was, you could take other people who've done, well, I mean, the very first thing was everybody complains about their job. You know, doesn't matter how unusual a job is, a premiership footballer, a rabbi, whatever it is, it soon becomes just another job. And it's by definition, when you're doing it day in, day out, it's your job, and people tend to complain about their jobs. But also the thing that I kept thinking about was, it's always the things that tie people together rather than the things that make them different. The rabbi I mentioned, for instance, he walks to work, he said, because it clears his mind. And a couple of chapters before that, there was a guy who works in a call center. And he always walks to work as well. But he listens to music to sort of stop me from thinking about the fact that I'm heading to work, he says. So it's the little similarities between these hugely different jobs that are a huge part of the fascination, I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's kind of a perfect snapshot of the world, the modern world of work in 2015. You mentioned baristas there as well. what do you think we learn about the modern world of work and the modern workforce in this book?
There's lots of the standard stuff you see in sort of economic textbooks about, you know, the insecurity, the days of a job for life have gone, and people chop and change jobs much more. You know, that when you know, 50 years ago, once you got a job, certainly as something like a lawyer, that would be it for life, really. You were set up. But now the legal aid lawyer is, I mean, he's a really interesting character. He was talking about, he hates the snobbery of all that old traditional stuff about the law. He hates the snobbery of gowns, and you wear a different colour gown or a different colour wig or a different colour ribbon on your gown, depending on what ranking you are as the lawyer. He says, I hate all that. I just want to get into a fight. You know, a really good example of, you can see why he went into that job. There's something in him that likes arguing, as well as the campaigning for social justice, and, you know, but he just likes a fight.
Interesting. I mean, some reviewers have said that Biggs, the author, could have been more political in this work, while others have kind of said that she's allowed politics to seep into the work too much. Where do you stand on that political question?
Well, I like the fact that it wasn't... What's the phrase that politics is personal? The political is the personal. You know, you don't talk about classes of people, huge, you know, all the tens of thousands of baristas in this country. You talk about one barista, and the best way into a subject is not by making an overtly political point, but just examining somebody's personality and the everyday reality of their job. And that's when shocking details can come in. To go back to the rabbi for a second, he said, just one of his throwaway sentences was that he'd done some sort of self-defense training because he said, I've been punched because of my job. You know, it's not that often, but it does happen. Well, it amazed me that it happened at all. You know, the people would see you on the street and because they see that you're a rabbi, they come up and punch you. And you could read all the articles in the world about anti-Semitism as a subject in itself. But it's that personal little detail, the individual story of what it means to a guy, a rabbi on the street who gets punched. That's really, I think, the power of the book.
It strikes me as well as a very kind of British picture that we get in this book. Do you think there's enough here of interest for an international reader, or do you think it is mainly a British audience that will enjoy this?
I would think so. I think people, well, for a start, certainly the jobs of the people that are based in London and also some of the others around the country, they're people from all over the world. Again, the sort of strange modern things that happen in the world of work. There's a shoemaker, he makes dancers' shoes, you know, ballet dancers, called Daniel, and lives in Hackney in London, but was originally born in Mexico and grew up in a circus family. So his first job was as a trapeze artist and a clown in a circus. And then he met a British woman and moved to England. But again, it's the little similarities. He said you have to be original as a clown. You have to have a face, a sort of thing that makes you very identifiable. And that's what he has in his current job as a shoemaker, because every shoemaker puts their own mark onto the shoe that they do. Literally, they all have their own individual mark. So, yeah, I think it's not a book about Britain. It's about individuals. And I think that the individuals have been well chosen and well written about, that I think they'd appeal to anybody, yeah.
That was All Day Long, A Portrait of Britain at Work by Joanna Biggs there. We're going to end the show with the re-release of John Pearson's The Profession of Violence, a biography of infamous criminal twin brothers Ronnie and Reggie Cray, who wreaked havoc in 1960s London. Their story is not just one of violence and mental instability, but there's also the kind of glamorous side as they mixed with the rich and famous and became celebrities in their own right. How are they portrayed in this book, Mark?
They're portrayed honestly, but only because they got arrested before the book could be finished. It's a really interesting story of how John Pearson came to write it. He was originally hired by the Crays, the London gangsters, to write their autobiography. So he was going to do they were paying him a lot of money, and he was going to write a fairly anodyne version. He was going to cover up the worst of what they'd done and write their official story. But then before the book came out, they were arrested and they ended up being sentenced to life. So by the time the book came out, he could be pretty honest. It's a fascinating story where, as the countless documentaries about the mafia around the world and organized crime, it's always a popular subject. There is a fascination with gangsters. Perhaps, I think, because they live a life where they can do whatever they want. If they decide they're going to go and get someone's business, they just walk in and physically threaten them until they take that person's business off them. They can go drink wherever they want, they can do whatever they want, say whatever they want. And I think there is a sort of subconscious, you know, wish all of us, which of us really doesn't want to be able to do that? Even if the nice part of us tells ourselves that we don't want to be that sort of horrible person or wouldn't want to do it through violence, there is certainly a subconscious fascination there with being able to live like that. But then also the social side of it as well. The Cray twins were born in poverty in the East End, and they ended up being friends with lots of the aristocracy. There's a big theme of how the middle class in a society is the one that gets left out. The very, very poor and the very, very rich, or the working class and the upper classes, always have a lot in common. There's something that, you know, that appeals to each other. And lots of those people, the aristocracy from the West End, would come out to the pubs that the twins owned in the East End, and they would mix. I mean, socially, it's a really interesting story.
That's interesting. You mentioned the fascination we have with mafia, with gangsters, which is definitely true. Reading this book, do you find yourself kind of won over by their charisma, like so many other people were, or is it more horrifying, really, than that?
It's certainly the latter. I mean, yeah, acknowledging that there is that interest there to start with, what I think is great about the book, and it was a good, you know, it was good that John Pearson could write the book honestly in the end, and he's honest about them. There's all that East End gangster myth about, oh, we never hurt women and children, you know, we only hurt our own, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, but they were psychopathic, and some of the violence is truly horrible. And in the end, the book tells you that these are bad people, not good people. But equally, how you get from one to the other, how you deal with that interest in the subject, but still acknowledge that in the end it's about violence and it's not pleasant. That's what makes it a great book, is it doesn't just say these are terrible people. It examines why we're interested in them. But in the end, it shows you that it's not a life that any of us would really want to end up. And all the gangsters themselves pretty much ended up unhappy. But along the way, there are some incredible stories, like of Bob Boothby, Lord Boothby, one of the aristocracy, took Ronnie Cray to his club in St. James's, one of the posh gentlemen's clubs in the West End of London. And Boothby asked him what he wanted to drink, and Ronnie Cray said, "Tell you the truth, I've always wanted to try one of those prawn cocktails." And there's a lot of comedy in there. There's a lot of tragedy, but there's a lot of comedy as well.
I mean, the timing of this re-release is interesting as well. We've obviously got Brian Helgeland's film Legend coming out later this year, starring Tom Hardy. Is that the main reason for the re-release, do you think?
Yeah, and that's the initial the reason. I mean, the book has never been out of print, and the craze have always been, there was a British film 20 years ago with the brothers from Spandau Ballet, the Kemp brothers, playing the twins. And now it's going to be really interesting to watch one guy playing the same two twins. That's why the book's come out. And it's still relevant. There are still people around. You know, since then, we've had the Guy Ritchie films and Gangster Chic and all that sort of stuff. It comes around in cycles. The book's coming out because of the film, and it's just an incredible story. I'd really recommend it.
Fantastic. The Profession of Violence is to be re-released in August by William Collins, and the film Legend will be in cinemas this autumn. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Mark Mason, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow for our film review, but for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.